Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and on this edition of Focus on Africa, it's a crowded field in Chad's presidential election, just 3 weeks away. So, does the opposition stand a chance at all? Also, a new dawn for Niger as Russian troops arrive. Is this a win for Russia as it broadens its influence in the Sahel? It's Tuesday, the 16th of April. But first, we start in Chad, where the interim president, Mahamat Idriss Deby, has begun campaigning for the presidential elections, which is meant to restore his country to democratic civilian rule. Deby will face 9 other candidates in the poll, scheduled for the 6th of May, including the junta-appointed Prime Minister, Sakse Masra. Reuters news agency quoted Mr. Deby as saying at his first campaign rally in the capital, Chamena, "You know me, I'm a soldier, and I hold my promises." He also pledged to strengthen security and guarantee Chad's peace and stability. Late yesterday afternoon, I called up Dr. Helga Dikau, who's a senior researcher at the Arnold Bach-Strasser Institute at the University of Freiburg in Germany. She's an expert on Chad and has just recently returned from Chamena. She gives us an insightful, overall detailed explainer on the country. She begins with the death of the former president 3 years ago.
If we go back to April 21, that's almost 3 years now, Chadians learned about the death of their longtime president Idriss Deby Itno, was killed while apparently visiting his troops who fought against political military rebellion in the middle of Chad. The conditions of his death are still unknown. So we know he was killed and Chadians learned from the television. And at the same moment, that was the 20th of April, they learned that a military council had taken over power. And this military council had nominated one of the sons, Mohamed Idriss Deby, as president of the military council, not yet of the transition, but of the military council. So at the same moment, they learned the death of their longtime leader and the nomination of his son. And this son is still in power 3 years later. And now on the 6th of May, he's facing the first election. So he has been in power for 3 years.
What sort of leader is he?
What is interesting, he belongs to a different ethnic group than all his brothers and the former ruling clan. So apparently his mother was a Goran, which is one of the big groups in northern Chad. I think that's important to know in ethnic and religious divided Chad. So he belongs to the north, but he doesn't completely belong to the Sagawa. He's a high decorated general. He fought in Mali and he also fought for his father political military rebellions like in 2019. And he served as the head of the Secret Service and the head of the Presidential Guard. So he's a highly military leader. In his first appearances on television and his first interviews, he seemed to be somebody who was kind of surprised to come to power. But behind the scenes, apparently, what one hears is that he's got the taste of power already. So he changed quite quickly from a young man who was kind of surprised to find himself in this position, because he was never talks about potential future successors of Idriss Deby. So he changed from somebody who seemed to be surprised to quite decisive political and military leader.
So he's up against 9 other candidates, including the junta's appointed prime minister. In this election, who's likely to win?
That's quite easy. I'm convinced, and I think most observers as well, that Mohamed Deby will win the elections.
What does that really say about the credibility of the elections? And what's the voting process like in Chad?
elections are not decided upon on the election day. I think one really has to look at the procedures before the election day. So here I'm talking about voter registration, the campaign. I mean, like yesterday, the official campaign was opened. Elections are 3 weeks ahead now. And one could see, I mean, the photos I saw, the films and pictures, that Mahamat Dibi had a big demonstration in a big place in N'Djamena with military presence. The prime minister passed through the city with all his followers following him in cars and motorbikes. And the other eight potential presidential candidates, they were just in their small vans somewhere. So the president and his prime minister, they can use all the state means, the cars, the petrol and all that for their campaign. But it's not only the campaign. I think voter registration was a very important issue, and voter registration took already place in August and September last year. And it took place at two different periods in the north and in the south. In the south, they started earlier. Both regions was 3 weeks. But in the south, it started earlier, and the south is more heavily populated than the north. And the voters in the south are more likely to vote for the opposition. And voters who turned 18 years after this voter registration, they cannot vote this May. So there is a certain bias. I mean, there are a lot of young people in the south and in the north, but in the south, there are more young people. They're just more potential voters who cannot vote now in the south than in the north.
So sort of like this is skewed in favor of Idris Deby, right? That's what you're saying. It's sort of like a done deal.
It's not a done deal. They registered earlier in the south, so they missed all these persons who turned 18 after registration date. So you miss out a high number of potential voters for the opposition. The other point I wanted to make is just as an example, because I read this week, the television broadcasting authorities, they forbid interactive broadcastings. That means there will be no discussions of whatever any potential candidate in the media. So what we know from the Western point of view, that candidates can discuss, potential voters can get their own view, that's not possible. We have the voter registration, we have the campaign, but more important, we also have the institutions. And here in Chad, in January, President Deby, he nominated members of two institutions. One was the Constitutional Court, who will validate the election results. And the other one is the Electoral Office, which they call in French Ange, which is Angel, Agence Nationale de Gestion des Élections. But there was the president himself who nominated the members of these two institutions for 7 years. They will be in office for that 7 years. So he himself nominated persons who will afterwards either deal with the elections or validate the elections. And the persons who are in these institutions were strong allies of his late father and longtime members of the former ruling party, the MPS.
Just looking back at how events have unfolded in the past 2 or 3 years, if you'd remember that Mr. Deby had initially promised that there will be an 18-month transition to democratic rule after he'd seized power in 2021. That's after the death of his father. Why has it really taken him so long to fulfill this promise?
They started from the scratch. All the institutions have been suspended, parliament, government and all that. And he promised Chadians in his first publications that he would involve all Chadians into the process of a national dialogue. And this national dialogue included also members of the political military opposition in exile. And for almost a year, people close to the transitional authorities toured really the world for talks with opposition members. And then we had at the beginning of 2020, we had the talks in Doha and in Qatar. It was a 4-month process, peace talks with so-called political military opposition, members of movements who tried to attack Idris Deby's rule. This lasted 4 months, but the problem was that there were so many, there was more than 40, almost 50 political military movements who were present in Doha, and some of them came direct from N'Djamena, so they were kind of made up for this occasion. And the real political heavyweights, like the FACT, who advanced towards Stamina when Idris Deby died, they were not even present. So at the end, there was a peace agreement with 40 movements and their leaders who came back to Jamena and to take part in the national dialogue, which could only start after this peace agreement. And then the national dialogue took place. It lasted for a month. And the decisions of the national dialogue said that transition would take another 18 months.
And there's been really a lot of fatigue because of that delay. And there's been a general concern that the transitional authority has really been acting not in their interest, but rather in the interest of the transitional president. That's Idris Deby. Is that an accurate reflection of the concerns that people have on the ground?
I think so. Yes, the extension served Mama Deby, the actual president. Yeah. I mean, now almost 3 years served him to expand his power. At the beginning, I said he is half Goran. For example, he used this time for a lot of changement also in the military sector. He changed a lot of generals of the Sagawa community to replace them with Goran officers and generals. He created a new security force unit, which is almost completely Goran. So he used this time really to expand his power and to settle in.
Has there been any change under his rule that has benefited ordinary Chadians?
This depends really whom you ask. There are Chadians. I mean, it's not that all Chadians are against Mahamat Deby. You could hear people saying, we did not have any rebellion anymore since he took over power. Also opposition leader Sukse Masra returned to Chad, but that's not what ordinary Chadians need. Of course, they need peace, but what they need is also political freedom. But Chad is one of the poorest countries in the world. They're starving of hunger. They have no electricity at the moment. They have no water at the moment. So it's a lot of window dressing when Mahamat Deby or followers of the transitional authorities say that life in Chad has changed for the better. And even when you look at his campaign and all what he's promising Chadians, I mean, one is actually wondering why he did not use the last 3 years for helping to get the lives of ordinary Chadians better, but why is he only promising that now? And people are starving at the moment. What got worse is the oppression, the political oppression. I mean, Chad has never seen so many dead like in the last 3 years. The level of political violence within the country is extremely high. I would say it's even higher than under his father.
If you look at the history of this country, it's prone to a cycle of violent rebellion and repression. Could peace and unity actually evade Chad once again this time?
My fear is that we are really going into another autocratic regime, which will try to last as long as possible. I mean, Mahamat Deby is the pupil of his father, Idris. Idris Deby was in power for 30 years, and I do not know if Mahamat Deby is preparing himself for staying in power for also 30 years, but all the events in the last 2 years show that he's willing to use everything to stay in power.
Dr. Helga Dikau, senior researcher at the Arno Backstreiser Institute at the University of Freiburg in Germany. Dozens of Russian military instructors have arrived in Niger. This is part of a new agreement to the country's junta, which has now cut links with the West. Niger state media had reported that the troops arrived with a state-of-the-art air defense system. They are expected to install this system and teach Niger's army how to use it. Now, the West African country is one of three countries in the region ruled by military authorities who have recently strengthened ties with Russia. A spokesperson for Niger's military government on Friday said that the Russians were in the country to train soldiers. I've been speaking to Kabir Adamu, a security risk management and intelligence executive based in Abuja, Nigeria.
Well, it appears to be an indication of the increasing growth of the relationship between Niger and Russia after the coup in July last year and the desire of the junta to have France leave Niger, and then with the junta moving closer to tie up relationships with countries like Russia, China, and then, of course, more recently, asking the United States troops to leave Niger. This is perhaps an indication of the consolidation of that move, rooted in the desire of the junta to whip up anti-imperialist sentiments in order to increase its popularity within locals who for a very long time have been nudging that Western anti-imperialist notion. And of course, the recent signing of an agreement between Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, where Russia has played a very significant role. So all of this is tying up together to show clearly that Niger is moving towards establishing a closer relationship with Russia.
So it was not a matter of if, but a matter of when. So is this a slap in the face of the French and the US who'd been kicked out of Niger?
Definitely. The developments that followed the July coup, we all saw how ordinary Nigerians were used to organized protest to get the French to leave Niger, even when the French initially opposed that. And then, of course, we've seen recently the Nigerian junta making a very bold statement, canceling the military agreements they have with the US. And then, of course, the US responding by saying it should be given time to come up with an exit strategy and all of that. So this was not what France would have wanted. It's definitely not what the US would have wanted after investing hundreds of millions of dollars in the construction of the military formations within Niger, and then also giving the strategic importance of those bases to the counterterrorism operations that the US is running. So yes, it is definitely a slap in the face of the Western, as it were, diplomacy. And the winner here appears to be Russia.
And just how prepared are the Russian forces to effectively operate in Niger, considering the security threats are coming from jihadist forces in the wider Sahel and then Boko Haram militants across the border in Nigeria?
So the best example of how prepared the Russians are is to review what they've been able to do in Mali since the junta there invited them over. What we've seen is two indicators. One, the presence of Russian military trainers supporting the Malian military. And then we've also seen the presence of the Wagner group deployed in parts of Mali. Now, unfortunately, for the Malian junta and for Mali as a country, these two indicators have not in any way helped improve security. Mali is still challenged by the activities of extremist groups, the activities of jihadist groups, and a significant percentage of the country is still under their control. If that is going to be a replication of what Russia would do in Niger, as we know at the moment, Niger is still being targeted by these terrorist groups. And it doesn't look like what Russia intends to do would be different from what it would do in Mali. So the region as a whole, especially the trio of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, it doesn't look like in the short term they will be out of the situation they are in the moment with Russian help. Now, more significantly for the wider Sahel, the breakdown of the collaborative effort to address terrorism, the G5 is as good as collapsed. And then the multinational joint task force, which has its headquarters in Chad, is also threatened by the fact that Niger, and to an extent Mali too, is no longer supportive of that arrangement. It's only Nigeria, Chad, and to an extent Benin Republic that are actively involved. And so there is a window that has been left open for these terrorist groups to capitalize on. So in the long run, it doesn't look like the regional counterterrorism initiative is looking good.
Right. And let's have a look at the presence of the Russian forces in Central African Republic, where they've been for a couple of years now. There have been reports of alleged human rights violation. How should people in Niger react to these new developments?
Two reactions. On the one, there are those who are very supportive of the anti-imperialist, anti-Western sentiment that the junta has been able to whip up. But there are also others who are concerned about the human rights record of both Russia and then more recently the junta. Journalists have been arrested. Opposition leaders are also arrested. The junta is yet to release a transition plan. And the more this relationship with Russia becomes more ingrained within Niger, the more unlikely the junta is to release a transition plan. So the civil society movements, groups, associations are very uncomfortable about that. And the longer the junta continues along this line not to release a transition plan, the more it continues to restrict civic space, the more we're likely to see reaction. Like I said, that the reaction is already beginning to emerge over the arrest of journalists and all of that. So, and of course, as we know, Russia does not really care about democracy. So it's not likely to put pressure on the Nigerian government to release that transition plan. And so it's just a matter of time, really, before we start seeing homegrown as opposition, as it were, to the military dictatorship that is likely to follow.
And finally, the million-dollar question. So what's in it for Putin's Russia in what is being seen as a form of wooing countries in Africa to gain a military foothold, specifically in West Africa?
So on the one hand, the economic advantage. In Niger, for instance, has substantial mineral resources. It has petroleum. It also has uranium. On the diplomatic side, Russia is increasingly being isolated as a result of happenings in Ukraine. And so the more friends it has in Africa, as it were, the more it could have some relevance, influence, you know, a buffer kind of option in multilateral platforms when it comes to issues that it would require support of more countries. And then lastly, of course, the geopolitical component, where this is essentially a tough war between it and the Western powers. And any advantage it's able to exert, both in terms of economic or political advantage, is to the disadvantage of the Western countries. And so from that geopolitical point of view, Russia's, you know, geopolitical strength is increased the more countries is able to establish relationships in the African continent.
Thanks to Kabir Adamu, Security Risk Management and Intelligence Executive based in Abuja, Nigeria. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. I'm Richard Kagoy. Let's go to our final story today. We're talking about how youth on the continent understand modern financial systems, like cryptocurrency, for example. Did you know over $100 billion is held in various cryptocurrencies in Africa? That may give you a clue as to where we're heading with our next interview. With the growth of the internet and digital gadgets, young people are looking at how they grow their wealth differently in comparison to how previous generations looked at it in the past. Traditionally, communities measured wealth by the amount of land one owned, for example, or the number of cattle they might have had. These days, it's the digital space that's influencing the thought of what has value. It's where the youth are learning about wealth, unlike chats around a fire passed down by previous generations, which is a reflection of what we are placing value in. So, to understand the dynamics of wealth today, my colleague Godfrey Brown spoke with Dolly Sagwe, a personal finance expert with an organization called ProsperPath in Nairobi.
Let's talk about wealth, because we're talking about the ways in which people perceive wealth or store wealth. Which is it? Tell me, perceiving or storing?
Mm-hmm. There's both. The way you perceive wealth is one thing. The way you store it is another. It's different conversations.
So tell us what you're finding in your organization.
What ProsperPath is coming to do is to say we have a need for education. And the reason why we're saying we have the need for education to understand how people perceive it, how people grow it, how people transfer it, and what people do with wealth once they have it. That whole cycle of what to do with wealth is what we want to address. And we're saying it can only be addressed through education first, and it needs to be done very fast because the rollout of technology is getting to young people in their 18, 19, 20 early years of adulting, where they have access to, say, credit, access to even wealth, even if they have received an inheritance, for example, but without knowledge of what to do with this wealth.
But there's also a changing perception of wealth, I believe. Tell us, what was the perception before? In other words, what did people think were things that created wealth or made them wealthy before, and what they think of as wealth now?
If I talk about my grandparents and their parents going back, the wealth was equal to land and animals, the stock you had. Wealth was also equated to the kind of positioning you had in the community, the honor, the reputation. So it was tangible and intangible. It was tangible with regards to physical assets, and those physical assets would be used to extract value. So from land, you grow your crop, you do your harvest, you barter trade, or you sell for money, depending on which season they lived in. The animals would multiply as well, but their name, their honor, their social placement in community, that was all signals of wealth. If we come to our time, land is finite. There's only so much land we can have. We have more younger people than the older people. So the wealth is knowledge. Actually, even then, they had the knowledge as wealth. Like, how much do you know and what do you know? What do you do with what you know? But the kind of knowledge we have now is different, but it's still knowledge. So knowledge is the tool I see that is common, one of the tools that is common in how wealth was gained those days in the past and still is today, but just different kind of knowledge.
So what's perceived as wealth, or what's the changing perception on what is wealth now and how you can store wealth or how you can parlay something into wealth?
So with that knowledge and the access through the internet and what we can access online, people are curious enough to figure out, how do I acquire wealth? And what is wealth? So we are seeing cryptocurrency coming in. And even before crypto, you would have stocks that were available. So in Kenya, for example, I would buy stocks from the Nairobi Securities Exchange for Kenyan companies. But because of the internet, I can access stocks from Hong Kong, from Australia, from the US, international stocks. So there's that part first and foremost. Then there's cryptocurrency that came in as a store of value, but also as an investment tool or an asset. So we went in and, you know, figured it out, just getting to learn, what is crypto? What does it do? How do I trade it? How do I get it back? So once that understanding came through, I guess in Kenya, maybe in the last 7-10 years, we are seeing very, very many young people now going into the crypto and trading crypto. They're also trading a lot of stock.
How well are they doing?
So it depends on how much they have invested in it. If you take a 15-year-old, and I do have 15-year-old nephews and nieces, they tell me I'm trading this crypto with fictional currency. It's not real currency, but they're trading it online on a platform. Much of what they are doing at the age of 15, 16, 17, without the money coming in, is monitoring what goes up, what goes down, what's gaining, what's losing. And at the end of the day or the transaction, what's my net position? Did I gain? Did I lose?
So they're learning.
So they're learning how to trade.
Without
the risk of it at that young age in their teens. The older ones, university level, beyond university, what I hear is they're talking about, this crypto is backed by X. This crypto has been adopted by this economy. And because of that, it is strong and safe. So the older they get, the more I see them understanding what's behind this currency beyond the trading.
So tell me this. Are there people actually that have been making money out of cryptocurrency, and are there people who are actually successfully able to find information that they actually need and accurate information? Because a lot of the information comes from, for instance, TikTok or Instagram, or seems like a spam email or a spam response in somebody's feed somewhere on social media.
I think it comes down to, what is it you're purchasing and how much do you know about it? So I don't look at crypto any differently than I do stocks or forex. So if you're going in to purchase an asset and you expect that asset to grow, then you need to do your research. For example, I have more understanding, and they would have more understanding and more information on Bitcoin, for example. But they would have less understanding and there may be less information on XYZ that was released maybe 2 months ago. So that approach you go into, which one do I buy and why, is the same as even when our grandmothers were and grandfathers were buying land. You need to understand, do I buy land, the one that's to the east and why, and the land that's to the west and why? Is it more fertile this side or that side? And what are the reasons behind it? The onus is on the investor to understand the fundamentals of making an investment decision. And that investment decision needs to be made based on research and enough knowledge. And of course, to understand there is a risk, and then you make an assessment of what kind of risk am I willing to carry.
So I'm wondering whether young people who are using these new ways of storing money and wealth and value know that, for instance, terms like stock comes from livestock, which is about cows and camels and goats and so on, that there's a straight line between these things. And is there anywhere where they can learn reliably about this?
There are programs online that are now taking people as young as 14, 13, 14. I have seen them affiliated to universities, affiliated to organizations that do investments and trade, there are programs for that. And there's a lot of information online. Unfortunately, what we find happening is that what we are searching for online is responding to a question that goes like, in your mind, a question that goes like, how do I make this work?
How do Not, I make money, in I, other words?
Exactly. And make money, more money yesterday. How do I do that? When you come with that approach, that's what you're going to be searching for online.
Do you have cryptocurrency?
Yes, I do.
Okay. You do. And all right, then. We've got to go. Thank you so much for your time and for your expertise.
Thanks. Bye.
Audrey Brown talking to Dolly Sagwe. Thanks for listening. This episode of Focus on Africa was produced by Charles Kitonga here in Nairobi and Victor Silva in London. Kane Sharp was in charge, and the technical producer was Chris Kazaris. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Modengi. Remember to check out our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's a deep dive each day into one story shaping the continent. I'm Richard Kagoe. We'll talk again next time.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.